Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Another C word there is California, which I often return to in my thoughts. It took me a while to realize that though I've only officially written one book about California, in some ways all of my work comes out of a certain experience and fascination and absorption of the state in terms of my own upbringing and family background to my fascination with the peculiar, wonderful experiments in counterculture and consciousness in technology, in media that helped make up this strange and fascinating place. Recently, I've been thinking and still pondering about the peculiarity that if the world wasn't already Californian through the mechanisms of Hollywood in the 20th century, it's certainly growing Californian as we dive ever deeper into the realms of digital technology, networking, the internet, mobile devices. Not only because companies like Apple and Google and Facebook are living here in California or sprouted from California, but that in many ways they carry with them some of the peculiar cultural DNA of this place in ways that can be both marvelous and somewhat disturbing. There's a sort of school of European critics of contemporary technology ideology that refer to a certain mixture of free market ideas with kind of hippie independence as the California ideology. So there's a way in which California remains a really crucial part of the debate. One thing very interesting about California, though, with which our guest today, Joseph Kittrey, points out in his book, Mountain of Paradise, which he published last year, the subtitle Reflections on the Emergence of Greater California as a World Civilization, is that in many ways California stands alone as a kind of civilization, or at least a nation state. It's one of the most powerful economies in the world, but in contrast to the other rival economies, it is not its own state. It is, or I mean, it's a state in the United States, but it is not a nation state. And so there's actually something kind of peculiar about it. Can we talk about California as a place distinct from the United States of America? And when you do allow yourself to do that, things actually open up and become more interesting. And particularly when you think about California's role in culture and consciousness, particularly now, but really throughout the 20th century and especially in the post-war period, then not thinking of California as just a kind of particularly weird and productive edge of the United States, but actually as its own space with its own histories that precede the United States of America taking over the territory, and that these elements are still floating around and in some ways perhaps even returning with a greater clarity and force, that I think we actually get a better handle on not just the state of California and its continued role as a kind of a petri dish and prophecy zone of the United States, but really to get a better sense of what's going on a global level as we plunge into our very weird century. So I'm really looking forward to chatting about these issues with Joseph. But before that, bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Good morning, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, so when did you move to California? I know you're from Washington, but when did you move here?
I moved here in the year 2000, and it's funny, like, I mean, traveling is a funny thing, and I know you can say, like, every land has energy, and it sounds really woo and new agey, but when I was a teenager, I was on the debate team, and we would travel for debate tournaments. I know, so dorky, but I would go to all these different states. You know, we would go to the East Coast. We would go to Middle America. We would go to Chicago. We would go all over Oregon and Washington and California. And when you enter California, you can feel it. Like, it's different. It's unique. I mean, you can argue every place is unique in its own way. But, I mean, you know, you go to New York, you feel New York. Like, it's just there, and you, there's its own kind of signature. And so when we talk about, you know, California as an area, I came here probably for the first time as a child on a road trip. And, I mean, it's a magical land. You can't, like, every time I would come here, I was just like, oh, my God, California. And it was like this magical place where it was beautiful and all the nature was incredible. And so I was so excited to move to California when I finally did in 2000 from Washington. And, I mean, I've just loved it ever since, every minute I've been here. I love it.
You know, at the, I always marvel at the attitudes that other people on the West Coast have in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia particularly, because there's sort of like a way in which California is this kind of extreme West Coast experiment, and yet it's very clearly very different than the Northwest in a lot of ways. And, you know, a lot of times people have grumbly attitudes about California who are from the northern part of the coast. And I was just curious, were there any of those attitudes that people had towards California more kind of, not negative, but just sort of, you know, maybe not entirely buying the hype, that when you came here, you realized were actually kind of true, or on the other side, like totally untrue?
Yes, very accurate. In fact, I remember living in Seattle, especially when I was in college, everyone literally would complain about the Californians, about them moving up, buying all this stuff. The main complaint was that they were just like these privileged folks, lots of money, that would just, like, you know, do whatever they want. Like, suddenly a complaint was that, oh, those Californians, they just do whatever they want, right? And so when I came here, I was like, yeah, people do. It's like a kind of rebelly individualism where people are encouraged to kind of follow, you know, their whims or dreams. So that was, like, people in the Northwest would kind of see them as these bulldozery, kind of straightforward, aggressive-y sort of types.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Also, I want to let you off the hook. Yes, debate society is geeky, but I was in Model UN, which was equally, if not more, geeky. And I didn't last very long, but I did hang on long enough to go up to Berkeley for the first time. There was a gathering in Berkeley. So I grew up in San Diego, North County, near Del Mar. And so I had never really visited Northern California, though. I was already fascinated with it and the hippie experiment and psychedelic culture. And so it was a wonderful experience to come up here in the early 1980s. And I still remember the way a lot of things looked then, so different than they are now. So, you know, there's something to be said for these nerdy high school activities that take you to interesting places.
Oh, yeah.
So with that in mind, let's bring on Joseph. Joseph, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a great privilege to join you.
Yeah, I look forward to this. I'm curious when you first got to California and when you started to realize that your interest was not just because it was an interesting place to work or you had good, you know, nice weather, but that it became a sort of a topic for you, a kind of almost, I won't say obsession, but something that you were really going to pursue very deeply as a non-native.
Yes. I came here in 1977, and I deliberately chose coming here, which for me meant Berkeley, as, in my view, the center of the world. I'd lived in many other places. I was actually brought up in three different countries, Czechoslovakia, Iran, and Brazil, before I immigrated to Florida when I was 10 years old. So I was in many different places, many different cultures and religions. And when the time came, which is to say after I finished my postdoctorate in Germany, I wanted to choose the place where I thought everything came to a head. And I chose Berkeley because, of course, I like university environments. I knew a lot about Berkeley in terms of its reputation in the 60s and 70s. But more broadly, California seemed to me to be the place where it all gathers and the big questions about world history, world cultures, and so on can be raised directly. And I was not disappointed because as time went on, I became more and more interested and fascinated by the further growth of California on many levels. And as I put together the facts, I think I was finally driven to write this book, which comes out of a series of articles in the first decade of this millennium, by the events of Iraq in 2002-2003. At that point, I was so frustrated by the policies of the time that I was struck all the more by figures that showed that Californians were going in a very different direction than the outright support for the Iraq War at that time, if you remember, Eric. And so I began by giving lectures on California civilization as something different to cover us in places like the Czech Republic, and from that developed further fascination, further interest, and a little more empirical work on the whole subject.
Well, I mean, I really want to emphasize that the all of the productive things that happen in your book by sort of, you know, grabbing you know, the bull by the horns and saying, no, we really need to look at this place as its own civilization, with all of the resonances of that term in terms of history, sensibility, aesthetics, philosophy, that there's something different here. And this is, you know, known in the trade as the question of California exceptionalism. And when I started to do research on California, I would come across this question. It's like, are we justified in thinking that while every place, as Maja said, is different, has its unique characteristics, there's something particularly unique to mangle grammar about California. And it was very clear to me right off the bat that I was an exceptionalist, that I did believe that the historical experiences here, the peculiarities and beauties of the nature, its relationship to other places in time and space, its ethnic makeup, even the history before contact, before Europeans came here, the state already seemed to have particular character, or the area already seemed to have particular characteristics in terms of the way that Native Californians inhabited the place, that seemed resonant with what ends up happening later on after all sorts of you know, bloodshed and takeovers. So I sort of recognized that right away, and I just would like to, you know, make the case, like, well, what is it that allows us to say not only that it's an exceptional state within the United States, but that it is kind of its own civilization on a world civilizational level, and that that actually helps you understand what's going on here.
Well, Eric, the term world civilizations, of course, is itself a very contestatory area. Lots of books have been written on the subject, and figures like Samuel Huntington with his famous Clash of Civilizations and others have given us a listing. I think in his case, there were 8 major civilizations, of which 5 were the most important. So what right do they have to do that? Of course, they're speculating as anyone else, and as they put together their evidence, it seems to me that California can meet many of those requirements by itself, quite apart from the rest of the United States. So starting with that, in other words, that it's a contestatory notion, in other words, one is providing candidates and one can see what happens with the candidates in comparison with other studies, California can make the argument on so many different levels. On that very crude level, which is to say economic strength, which you brought up earlier, Eric, it is worth reminding ourselves that ever since 2000, particularly, when you do the GDP ratings, these are the familiar ratings in terms of economic strength, and of course they're questionable, but they're questionable for everyone, we find out that California is somewhere between 5th and 8th over the last 10 years. Right now, by right now I mean 2013, we're number 8 if we were a separate country, just under, actually, Brazil, UK, and France. So another great upsurge could get us right back into the status of 5 or 6. And it's worth remembering that, of course, our population is much smaller than those of our rivals along this listing. Again, as I say, that's a crude kind of point to make, but nonetheless, it's part of the general argument. Then much more broadly, I think, Eric, we have to take into account the story of California well beyond its accession into the United States in 1848-1850. Of course, all that is part of Native Californian history, and more specifically in terms of the establishment of the name of California and the concept of a California, it's a very Latino concept, since it was none other than, as best as we can tell, Hernan Cortes, who named California, starting with La Paz, Baja California, and then the term was extended through the rest of California. And for the most of that history, when one said California, sometimes one talked about Upper and Lower California, but when one talked about California, it wasn't just the present state of California. It was Baja California, it was much of Arizona, Utah, and Nevada. It was a very large area, and although that area was not all that greatly occupied in certain parts, still, it was not just a very small part of the Spanish and then later the Mexican areas of control. And out of that, I think, came a very international concept of California. But it was, I think, as it were, supported by a kind of ecological confirmation that California, as originally seen, was an island. Now, in fact, of course, it's not an island, although it was considered to be an island as late as 1747. But in many ways, ecologically, it is a semi-island, and there are some very interesting books in terms of geology, plants, and so on, which show that California is quite distinct in terms of its whole environmental qualities, which has had a very strong effect, I think, on the life of Californians here in terms of emphasizing a kind of diversity that stands out. Diversity, even going back to the native Californian cultures, which had something like over 100 mutually incomprehensible languages and lived in very localized settings. And I think all of that put together begins to make the case, very interestingly, that California is quite unique. Now, as both of you have said, it's certainly true that any place can make its argument, and of course one is privileged to do that. If you are a denizen of, I suppose, North Dakota, you can go ahead and make the argument. But when the arguments are all added up, how many parts of what are now called the United States could really qualify on this scale? Possibly Texas, New York in certain ways, but that's pretty well it. And even there, California is something like 2 times larger in its economy than the next state, which I believe is Texas, at least in terms of the latest ratings.
Yeah, but it's the size and the ecological diversity and the power of the economy, all of those things I think are pretty evident. What's more interesting, and what you tease out in a number of ways in your book, is a particular ethos, let's say, that despite the diversity, and certainly the diversity of peoples, one that I think puts California in the position to at least potentially embrace this fully diverse future present that we're already engaging with better than a lot of other places on the planet, probably than most places, that there's still nonetheless, I think we can talk about a kind of ethos, whether that has to do with dreams, whether it has to do with the way in which dreams and emotions and fantasies get wound up with technology, with industries. Maybe that's something specific about it, or the sense of religious diversity, which is, of course, a particular interest of mine. Also, I know is also an interest of yours, but it also says something deeper, even beyond the question of religion. Why here did all of this diversity and experimentation happen? So in terms of this sort of deeper ethos or aesthetic or philosophy of living, what are some of the key points for you in terms of characterizing California?
Well, of course, this is one of those questions that can go on forever. My own attraction to California on this level is, I would say, a very strong aesthetic orientation, which allows for imagination as well as for, one might say, recreating oneself, refashioning oneself, transforming oneself. And perhaps this possibility is part of the not accidental, but historical fact that California has been physically at the edge of the American experience, so that anyone seeking a new life, seeking a new way of doing things, would end up coming here. But California also acted that way for others coming from other parts of the world. For example, the Gold Rush is a very good example of how California became the point of reference for thousands and thousands of people coming from even Australia, Chile, Sonora, as well as, of course, from the United States and parts of Europe. All of them came with perhaps a very narrow notion of wealth, but that possibility then expanded very quickly into taking on experimentations. Mark Twain, for example, referred at the time, he was here, of course, a little bit after the Gold Rush, to this kind of argonautic quality of Californians, that they were willing to jump in and try anything new. And I think there's this connection between, if you will, economic possibilities, the natural wealth of California, and its curious position on the edge of both the American experience and also of non-American experience across the Pacific and coming up from Latin America. And so I think the end result is that a certain unfolding of keeping this game going of transformations, of experimentation, of innovation, took off very quickly. I think it was Kevin Starr, our great historian of California, who said, in California, the lights went on all at once, and they've never turned off. So that there has been a quickened pace in California economically, which has, I think, supported the idea of innovation, experimentation, and so on. And that has spread across many areas in a narrow sense in terms of economic and technological innovation, but also in a personal sense in terms of attempting new ways of life, new forms of imagination, and as you correctly point out, all kinds of experimentations in religiosity, which I think is very well presented in that book of yours, which I love, The Visionary State. So
it's
going into recreation, imagination, self-transformation has become such a feature of California that it would be very hard for there to be a counter movement that would undercut that at all. And again, the natural wealth of California is quite astounding. I mean, it's available, it was available from the start, and one can call upon it, which of course augments and makes possible experimentation.
Well, one of the interesting things about that that culture of personal transformation, of aesthetic play, of masks and theater of the self, is that it's really noticed. It's very visible inside of some of our major industries now, particularly in technology. And I, you know, I've often thought about how one of the signs of the kind of contemporary Bay Area influenced office is that it has a certain kind of informality. You know, the classic example are the sort of technological offices where there's, you know, frisbees and, you know, bean bags and this whole kind of like loose, playful environment, this sort of breakdown of work and play, which of course is a double-edged sword. Nonetheless, it's this fascinating situation, and I always would think about it. I'd trace it back to, let's say, Xerox PARC in the early 70s, where a lot of the features of what would come to be the personal computer were sort of developed in this R&D kind of setting. And it was a very hippie environment, and there's all sorts of like informality around it, and that kind of influenced the sense that this is actually a more productive way to organize an office space. But then reading your book, you have this wonderful and kind of a marvelously eye-opening chapter on Walt Disney, where you're talking about a lot of the same elements we can trace all the way back to him in terms of building what you call emotional environments. And these are environments not just in terms of Disneyland itself as a kind of environment to explore the city and pleasure fantasy, but also just in terms of how he structured the workplace and how he organized animators and other people to sort of create this powerful industry. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about Disney, especially because now, given the corporation and so many issues, it's very easy to have a very negative view or just to kind of take it on board that, of course, Disney was a conservative, and he was trying to manipulate, and it's created this culture of lies and of racial and gender stereotypes that we're trying to get out from under these days. But you have a much more nuanced and in many ways positive view of Disney as a kind of figure for a certain kind of California culture, California industry.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up Disney, and you're perfectly right that he has a bit of a checkered reputation. When I became interested in him, it was actually because I was much more interested in the studio system. So that one actually has to begin with that, which itself is the result of prior developments. In my view, one has to remember that from, let's say, the 1850s on, large numbers of people also came here, this is well after the Gold Rush, in order to create their own unique kind of community. They were across the board in terms of people coming from the Midwest and creating, for example, Pasadena or other cities, and actually thinking in terms of a whole new communal structure. These experimentations were across the board, certainly in Southern California, but also in Northern California. And then out of that, I think, came the understanding when Hollywood began to take off, as literally Hollywood around 1910, 1920, that one could do the same thing by creating studios. That idea itself was a brilliant innovation on the part of the first figures in Hollywood. We all know the famous names that established the studios. But the question here is, why did they even think of it? For example, Universal Studios, which started in 1915, conceived of itself as a kind of semi-independent communal space with all of the amenities, including the infrastructure, fire station, healthcare, and so on, to provide for a living space for innovative creation, at least as far as they saw it. Some people may not think so highly about Universal's products, but that became the kind of model, and when Disney came to California from the Midwest, his first inclination was to go to these studios literally and to, as it were, breathe in the air of these incredible spaces. And out of that, he gradually developed his own idea of a studio and went in the direction of making sure the studio was more like something like, you might say, an Ivy League campus, not a strict industrial center, but in fact a place for ideas flowing back and forth. He had his own canteens. The only thing that he didn't provide, I think, was housing. But otherwise, his studios were meant to be living spaces for individuals to gather and come up with original ideas. And he himself was a very charismatic figure in terms of inspiring others, in terms of how he would get ideas going, how he would link up the visual with the, if you will, the theatrical, in terms of what they wanted to try. And once he had more or less got that going, and then eventually, of course, he created his own studio from scratch in 1940 in Burbank, then his ideas expanded and eventually, of course, led towards the conception and creation of the first true, if you will, entertainment park, which would be Disneyland in Anaheim. I would add also that Disney was always trying to expand this idea, not as someone who wanted to be a mogul, but as someone who wanted to see how far it would go. So his later experiments included, helping to create CalArts, the great center for study of the arts, but also in relation to filmmaking. He also had a massive idea of a kind of urban center, which he wanted to establish in Disney World. That was the only reason he was agreeable to the creation of Disney World in Orlando, because otherwise he wasn't interested. It wasn't that he thought in terms of creating a whole series of Disneylands as exists today. That was the conception of his brother and those who took over the operation. But he himself was only interested in seeing how he could widen the idea, going again first from the concept of a movie studio, animation studio, then to the park, Disneyland, then to something wider like an educational institute, and finally to the idea of an urban center, which he was actually going to create next to the Disney World in Orlando. Unfortunately, at that point he died, sadly, he was quite a smoker. And so his grand idea was just dropped by his brother, who was much more of a, you might say, a practical entrepreneur in terms of creating businesses. And from that, you have the further evolution of Disney into the massive corporation that we know about today. But that certainly wasn't Walt Disney's intention in any way. His aim was to continue to experiment with creating living spaces within which one could have imagination, aesthetics, theater, and see where that led in terms of a much more human mode of interrelationship.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, and then we'll have to take a break after that. That, you know, you've studied philosophy, you've studied critical theory. In fact, one of the really interesting bits of your book is a discussion of how intellectuals and philosophers have seen California, and particularly for me, some of the discussion towards the end of how, you know, critical French philosophers like Foucault and Derrida sort of related to California, and particularly with Foucault, who I think you write very correctly argue made his sort of last sort of intellectual shift partly through his experience of and kind of immersion in California. But of course, for a lot of intellectuals and critics, social critics, Disneyland is the epitome of false consciousness, of bad faith, of a sort of entrapment where our dreams and unconscious fantasies are sort of brought into a kind of a corporate, surveyed, controlled environment. And, you know, I'm not telling you anything you haven't already heard, you know, from this. These are very readily available ideas in terms of thinking about culture and thinking about the sort of emotional environments that you're talking about as they become part of capitalism and our culture. But because I think this is a really central question about how we think about California, not just how we think about Disney, I'd love to hear you respond to that. Like, in what ways do you think these pessimistic or cynical critiques of a place like Disneyland with its desires for a more imaginative life, what do you think is being missed in that? Because in some ways that has to do with what's being missed about California.
Well, I think that a lot of the concerns and critiques are on the right track, because in the final analysis, wherever you have a situation, a condition in which some sort of fee is required, and of course the fee to attend Disneyland, I can't remember what it is now, but it certainly cleared $100 when I was last there, limits the number of people who could, in fact, afford to enter it. And then also the fact that money is being, taking part in the whole process is bound to have certain effects that are questionable in terms of the experience itself. Here is a line that I think is worth continuing to critique. It continues to be an issue, however, not just with regard to Disneyland, but with regard to other theories about the further development of capitalism in terms of moving beyond service economies to what some are calling an experience economy. Now, whether all that belongs to the kind of language that is meant to obfuscate the continued growth of, if you will, profit-oriented control over our lives, or in fact also bear certain, if you will, emancipatory conditions, is the open question that one needs to continue to discuss. So I certainly have no objection to the concern of many that insofar as you create a space like Disneyland and you charge for it and you, as some would say, manipulate the experiences, there could be limitations of the kind of results that follow. And I think that has to be empirically then considered. And by empirical, I mean it would require and has required the study of those who have gone through the Disneyland experience, the kind of effect it has had, using, again, psychological and sociological testing devices. And my general sense is that the results are reasonably benign. I don't see, a terrible, if you will, monopolizations of one's imagination. Disney himself wanted to somehow preserve or bring to the attention of individuals and families certain feelings that go with early maturation, moving somewhere between childhood towards, if you will, early teenaged, certain memories, certain feelings of landscape and events and experiences. And he thought that overall that would be actually very beneficial to the individual. I don't think he had a grand plan of controlling imagination. And again, as I say, this requires empirical analysis in terms of what really results when people come out the other end after they've spent, let's say, a day at Disneyland. My own impression, again, and it's not that these data are skewed in favor of Disneyland, is that all in all, it doesn't seem to be creating automatized creatures, but in fact does produce some very beneficial experiences. I'm not quite sure we want to go to the extent of saying it's the, well, how do they call it, the capital of happiness and so on, but I don't see it as the kind of manipulative control that perhaps certain extreme critics are bringing against it.
Great. Well, we need to take a break right now. I have
sure.
a lot more questions. So you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Joseph Kittry about California, and we'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more cutting-edge viewpoints on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Eric Davis, and I'm proud to be part of the PRN family of hosts and the work we do here promoting progressive ideals for inquiring minds. For the past 12 years, PRN has been advertisement-free and has never held a fundraiser. However, over the past few years, it is becoming increasingly difficult, and the time has come to ask for your support. Won't you be a friend of PRN and commit to a monthly recurring donation of $20, $50, $75, or $100? This will ensure that PRN will be able to continue to bring you the latest breaking stories and hottest topics reported and discussed from a progressive point of view. Just go on PRN's homepage and click on the subscribe button. With each subscription, you will receive a free DVD from the Gary Noel Library. Thanks for your support.
Stay tuned to PRN.fm for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis. We are talking with Joseph Kittry, and we're talking about California. Joseph, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Disney and making utopias, and I wanted to ask you about the mythology of California a little bit. I had been only familiar with the story of the name that was from Califia, or that Amazonian queen, where they traced the etymology of the word California back to, you know, this mythical story that someone had wrote about this Amazon queen and population of people. And I had never heard that other etymology that you write about in the book, about it being the mountain paradise. And that was very interesting to me, because if you look at, you know, of course, all these stories of utopias and paradises, in most religions, even going back to prehistory, they have like mountains and trees are kind of like the big thing, right? There's like the world tree is this very important figure in paradise. Obviously, in the Garden of Eden, we get, you know, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. And of course, in California, there's some of the oldest, largest trees that live on the planet Earth. And I just thought it was interesting how you trace that Persian version and look at the history of the word in Persia, since of course in paradise, in the Persian versions, if you look at the Persian versions, if you look at the tree of life, it's like this pine cone tree. And I mean, the oldest trees in California are like the bristlecone pines. So mm-hmm. What did you find, like, any in terms of that, those paradise mythologies, was there anything else other than just the kind of nomenclature that you found profound in your research in that area?
Well, in fact, I won't say I was cheating, but I love the term Mountain of Paradise, and it really comes from an obscure article in the 20s, which was picked up by Carrie McWilliams, who's one of the best-known historians of California, as you may know. He thought that was the best guess for the origin of the word itself. But I have to admit, and I do mention it in my book, that I checked with many students and experts on the ancient Persian languages, which of course go through different stages like Vestan and Pahlavi before they become Farsi, and nobody was really able to give me a convincing confirmation of it. So I stuck with the term because I liked it since I myself was born in that area and enjoyed the implications. Now, the Mountain of Paradise can probably be linked to Sufi ideas of something called Mount Kaf, which is a kind of emerald mountain, as you say. It's a mythical conception of making your way to the truth, crossing a bridge, and then finally arriving at this emerald city, you might say, which does resemble Oz. And of course, the author of Oz moved to California. The first book was not written in California, but all the other books, some people don't know that, there's a whole series of Oz books, was written in fact, Southern California. But actually, I did a lot with the other and the genuine basis of the word California. Again, the word California existed, and it's not clear where it came from, but we're guessing it came from the Islamic side somehow and made its way into Iberia or Castilia, where it was picked up somehow. Now, the book that you're mentioning is actually a series based on medieval tales called the Amadis de Gaula. There were many stories in different languages, Portuguese, French, Castilian, and so on. And this gentleman named Montalvo, García Rodríguez de Montalvo, put them together in three volumes as Amadis de Gaula in Spanish, Castilian, then added a fourth volume, and finally he himself, as he puts it, wrote his own fifth volume, which is called The Deeds of Esplandian, or Serras de Esplandian. Esplandian in the mythology is the son of Amadis, who is a great knight errant. And in that volume, chapter 157 brings up for the first time an island called California, and as you correctly point out, it's ruled by a beautiful black Amazonian queen called Calafia. And so that's how it enters into the scene. So this volume seems to have been with Cortes and the men who conquered Mexico. We have evidence of that in terms of a book by Bernal Diaz del Castillo, who was with Cortes and who mentions the book and says that the book was like the image of Mexico City. So we can easily guess that when Cortes and his men explored going to the west, what became for them the island of California in La Paz, they used the word California to name that area, and then the word itself was expanded to cover more of what we call California as explorations extended up towards the 42nd parallel. So that's how the word itself came to use, but its basis is unclear. The Persian suggestion is one. There's another suggestion coming from a place in Morocco. And so all we can say is that somewhere in the 11th century, the Song of Roland, which is a famous medieval work, refers to Califeren as one of the forces on the Islamic side. So the storyline really begins with Cortes, insofar as we can tell, the greatest of the conquistadores, although he has a checkered reputation, of course, for what he did, naming a land as California. And from that point on, the storyline took off. But what interested me about this connection, as someone who's an intellectual historian, is that given that link, one could then work back all the way to ancient Britain, which itself was founded, according to mythology, by a relative of Aeneas, who himself was a Trojan, who founded, of course, Rome. And so the grand genealogical move I make in one of my chapters is to argue that California really, in terms of naming and mythology, goes back to what I would call is the most imposing pedigree in Western mythologizing and genealogizing.
Wow, that's really, and it's strange though that it would have those kind of links on such epic levels when it does get so utopian, because I always think it's funny how names reflect you know, obviously situations and looking into the history of those things, I'm sure as you experienced, there's always like some kind of breadcrumb trail trying to get like kind of more data and information on the emotional kind of meaning that humans put on environmental places.
Well, that's perfectly true. Of course, there's no single name for the area we call California as far as what we would call Native Californians are concerned. You have a whole series
right.
of diverse stories, but in terms of some sort of unificatory package of concepts, that's really brought by the Spanish, and it stuck. And, of course, then when the Mexicans lost the war in 1848 to the Americans, this grand land, which was called California or Las Californias, was broken up into several units. But it is interesting to note, and I mentioned it in my book, that in the early negotiations in terms of what the U.S. is going to do with that space, one very powerful suggestion was that all of what we call Southwest U.S. would be California. That, in other words, California would have included Nevada, Utah, Arizona, and even New Mexico. That idea didn't come through because of certain political factors, and so we end up with the California that we know in terms of the state boundaries. But it's also a reason why my book is not just about California civilization, but suggests that maybe there's such a thing as a civilization of greater California in the making. And I've had a certain reaction to that by those who are in Arizona, Utah, and so on. My suggestion was not to bring up the thought that California should absorb these other places, but rather to acknowledge, and I go into that in some detail in one of my chapters, to acknowledge that California's impact on what was called Greater California is immense. Its impact
right.
economically on Nevada, also on Baja California, is immense. And one should acknowledge that because I think actually it's a responsibility for Californians to recognize it.
You know,
yeah.
We've got about eight minutes left here, and one of the things that comes up when talking about California and both in the if you want to make a case that some of the values associated with it, however they've been tarnished in various ways, are still valid, and there's still things that we're going to be working with one way or the other, and so we need to keep working on them as positively as possible. One of the great contradictions that a more critical view of the state would remind someone making that case is I think the prison population, that one of the if the, it's the irony of the fact that this state associated with self-transformation, with freedom, with liberty, with new inventions, put so many people behind bars. Now, there's all sorts of specific reasons we could get into. Nonetheless, I think that the symbolic weight of that, if you will, the political challenge of that, does sort of point out the way in which, like a lot of paradises, like a lot of places that sell their good points, that transform themselves into kind of models of a possible life. There's also this dark underside that gets even more sort of pushed to the side because it doesn't really accord with the official story. I think you can talk about information technologies in a similar way, and companies like Google and Apple, and how they outsource some of the more reprehensible parts of industrialism so that they can maintain their image as a kind of delightful science fictional transformative environment. But this question about the prisons and that sort of contradiction there really says something about the darker side of the state as well. And I'm just kind of curious how you weave those stories and those counterclaims into your vision of a place that deserves to be thought of in many ways as a civilization with positive values and important values for the world.
Well, notice, Eric, that you finished off by saying a civilization with positive values. Of course, I don't need to go that far. I'm being positive generally, but all I need to establish, which is a task in itself, is the claim that very few people have acknowledged or even wanted to include in their discussions, namely that California is a civilization that deserves to be given the same, as it were, attention as, I would say, Europe, China, and so on. That's a pretty large claim, I think you'll agree, and that's all I need to do, and it's a lot of work. once that's established, if it is established, then, of course, there are positive and negative features. Any civilization has that. There's no question about that. To establish something like that doesn't mean, therefore, one is also claiming that there are no flaws. On the contrary, in fact, the flaws will be highlighted in terms of now being the object of direction by those who recognize the uniqueness of California, that one shouldn't just look to the rest of the United States for the solutions, but Californians have to come up with solutions to, as you very correctly point out, the dark side. So with regard to the prison population, of course, this is a very large topic, and I think you and I sort of touched on it in one of the presentations that was given at that recent California Religion conference that we both attended. My question, or I would begin my question by asking, how many of those individuals are there because of drug associated offenses? And then I would ask myself, what kind of position would be taken by Californians if they could actually control their legality with regard to drug policy? Would that make a substantial difference in terms of reducing the numbers who are presently incarcerated? In other words, to what extent is the presence of the prison population and its cross-section a reflection of larger forces at play coming out of the United States as a whole? And to what extent would more uniqueness to California help to mitigate some of those conditions? But that's, of course, just to mitigate some of those conditions, because the rest of it does have to do with, as you, I think, were suggesting here and there earlier, the complexities of, after all, a capitalist society. And if any society is very much tuned in to certain important features, positive and negative, of capitalism, it's California and its economy. So definitely that would be a whole series of very serious critical studies that I would be only too happy to engage in once I've completed at least this preliminary stage, which is to bring to the attention of an audience the what I claim to be the importance of California civilization as such. And finally, of course, I'm not in any way speaking about a uniqueness that's separate from the rest of the world. Any place, any civilization is intertwined with all the other civilizations. There's no such thing as complete uniqueness. We all agree with that. That's a simple point, but worth bearing in mind.
Oh, absolutely. I think what I was more getting to is if we identify it, you know, let's just go run with it. It is a civilization. It has its own values, its own dynamics that need to be identified in a unique way. And I guess part of my question was that whether some of the problems that we see with California, one could also talk about the proposition ballot system and the kind of difficulties that makes for state governance, you know, and a number of other political questions, whether the specific form of these problems has to do with those values or whether they're just, you know, other things that happen to any given civilization. And so that's kind of the interesting thing, whether there are some in identifying particular characteristics of the civilization. Do you see certain aspects of it that lend themselves to particular kinds of problems?
Absolutely. There's no question in my mind that to the extent that one emphasizes, again, self-transformation, innovation, after a certain point, one obviously is supporting a certain level of instability, which will express itself in terms of important distinctions of wealth, class, and the results, of course, are felt, as you say, in the prison system and the manner of a very separate existence, some of which are quite desirable and some of which are quite questionable. I think certainly that's part of, we might say, the other side of the coin in terms of the California propensity to constantly experiment and to try to come up with new solutions. But again, the other side of the positive side is this push towards solutions could also be the saving grace. Certainly in the case of the history of the United States in the last 50 years, if you look at the really major positive changes that have taken place, again and again, I think you'll agree, Eric, it seems to start in California, whether it's environmentalism, the whole issue of same-sex marriage, etc. All of that is in many ways California.
Yeah, but it's funny too is that, and you mentioned this as well, we also have to remember that so is the backlash, that a lot of the conservative backlash, let's say the new conservatism that kind of emerges, let's say in the 1960s, and then gets, you know, carries forward until it puts Reagan into the White House, of course, another Californian, is that some of the right-wing developments or conservative developments in the United States are also traceable to California, like the John Birch Society and certain kinds of libertarian ideas. So that's another interesting side of the state that the more I learn, the more I recognize is that some of the really important currents of conservatism are also linked to the experimental environment of new possibilities in the state in a very paradoxical way.
Well, that's perfectly true. At the same time, you then have the swing in the other direction, namely that population patterns have developed in such a way that Orange County, which was the home of John Birch and Reagan and so on, is now becoming increasingly Democratic because of a much more mixed population. Moreover, I think I mentioned in my book, there's some very interesting and, I would say, heartening statistics showing that we've moved probably beyond what used to be called the migration magnet of California, that is to say a lot of movement coming in and out, to something like a much more homogeneous majority in the sense that over 70% of people born or who are now of the age of 15-24 have been born and reside in California. And that, I think, is going to help to establish a certain level of stability that may not have existed in those 30-40 years where you have the John Birchers and many other forces at play. But even so, there are going to be counterforces coming into play. Overall, though, again, if you look across the board, California, in terms of its voting patterns over the last 10-20 years and increasingly now, stands completely apart from what's taking place in the rest of the United States. And I think that was just reconfirmed in the recent midterm elections. So although there are backlashes and back and forth, still we have to say that California is as blue as you can get.
Yeah, and I still feel that even beyond the specific issues of electoral politics, that culturally it still has a great potential, and it's, you know, and it's based on a reality. But to really engage the challenges and potentials of diversity. And while that's not necessarily by no means across the board, I mean, there's a lot of information now about how much white privilege is in Silicon Valley, how gendered those companies are, and that there is a sort of there are some serious blocks. I also feel, at least as a resident, you know, observing my experience in the time and talking to so many people, that there's a real possibility for a different way of navigating cultural difference than we've seen, including in the state's own negative histories and racist problems. But it seems like there's a real possibility there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm extremely optimistic, and although optimism shouldn't just be connected to economic developments, I think that in the last few years, and especially the last 2 years, we're seeing a nice growth of the economy, which all in all can give us much more room to maneuver. We have a state surplus now, in many ways, thanks to a very effective politician, Jerry Brown. And I think we have much more room to maneuver over the next 3-4
Joseph,
years, and
hey,
I hope we don't waste it.
We're going to have to cut it off there. So
sure.
Thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
All right. From me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.